This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents She Has Her Mother's Laugh. The Powers, Perversions, and Potential of Heredity by Carl Zimmer. Read for you by Joe Ackman. To Grace, for spending this juncture between the past and the future with me. The whole subject of inheritance is wonderful. Charles Darwin. Prologue. The worst scares of my life have usually come in unfamiliar places. I still panic a bit when I remember traveling into a Sumatran jungle only to discover my brother Ben had dengue fever. I lose a bit of breath any time I think about a night in Bujumbura where a friend and I got mugged. My fingers still curl when I recall a fossil-mad paleontologist leading me to the slick, mossy edge of a Newfoundland cliff in search of Precambrian life. But the greatest scare of all, the one that made the world suddenly unfamiliar, swept over me while I was sitting with my wife, Grace, in the comfort of an obstetrician's office. Grace was pregnant with our first child, and our obstetrician had insisted we meet with a genetics counselor. We didn't see the point. We felt untroubled in being carried along into the future, wherever we might end up. We knew Grace had a second heartbeat inside her, a healthy one, and that seemed enough to know. We didn't even want to find out if the baby was a girl or a boy. We would just debate names in two columns, Liam or Henry, Charlotte or Catherine. Still, our doctor insisted. And so one afternoon we went to an office in Lower Manhattan, where we sat down with a middle-aged woman, perhaps a decade older than us. She was cheerful and clear, talking about our child's health beyond what the thrum of a heartbeat could tell us. We were politely cool, wanting to end this appointment as soon as possible. We had already talked about the risks we faced starting a family in our 30s, the climbing odds that our children might have Down syndrome. We agreed that we'd deal with whatever challenges our child faced. I felt proud of my commitment. But now, when I look back at my younger self, I'm not so impressed. I didn't know anything at the time about what it's actually like raising a child with Down syndrome. A few years later, I would get to know some parents who were doing just that. Through them, I would get a glimpse of that life, of round after round of heart surgeries, of the struggle to teach children how to behave with outsiders, of the worries about a child's future after one's own death. But as we sat that day with our genetics counselor, I was still blithe, still confident. The counselor could tell we didn't want to be there, but she managed to keep the conversation alive. Down syndrome was not the only thing expectant parents should think about, she said. It was possible that the two of us carried genetic variations that we could pass down to our child, causing other disorders. The counselor took out a piece of paper and drew a family tree to show us how genes were inherited. You don't have to explain all that to us, I assured her. After all, I wrote about things like genes for a living. I didn't need a high school lecture. Well, let me ask you a little about your family, she replied. It was 2001. A few months beforehand, two geneticists had come to the White House to stand next to President Bill Clinton for an announcement. We are here to celebrate the completion of the first survey of the entire human genome, Clinton said. Without a doubt, this is the most important, most wondrous map ever produced by humankind. The entire human genome that Clinton was hailing didn't come from any single person on Earth. It was an error-ridden draft, a collage of genetic material pieced together from a mix of people, and it had cost $3 billion. Rough as it was, however, its completion was a milestone in the history of science. A rough map is far better than no map at all. Scientists began to compare the human genome to the genomes of other species in order to learn on a molecular level how we evolved from common ancestors. They could examine the 20,000-odd genes that encode human proteins, one at a time, to learn about how they helped make a human and how they helped make us sick. In 2001, Grace and I couldn't expect to see the genome of our child, to examine in fine detail how our DNA combined into a new person. We might as well have imagined buying a nuclear submarine. Instead, our genetics counselor performed a kind of verbal genome sequencing. She asked us about our families. The stories we told her gave her hints about whether mutations lurked in our chromosomes that might mix into dangerous possibilities in our child. Grace's story was quick, Irish through and through. Her ancestors had arrived in the United States in the early 20th century, from Galway on one side, Kerry and Derry on the other. My story, as far as I understood it, was a muddle. My father was Jewish, and his family had come from Eastern Europe in the late 1800s. Since Zimmer was German, I assumed he must have some German ancestry, too. My mother's family was mostly English, with some German mixed in, and possibly some Irish. Although a bizarre family story clattered down through the generations that our ancestor who claimed to be Irish was actually Welsh, because no one would want to admit to being Welsh. Oh, I added, someone on my mother's side of the family had definitely come over on the Mayflower. I was under the impression that he fell off the ship and had to get fished out of the Atlantic. As I spoke, I could sense my smugness dissolving at its margins. What did I really know about the people who had come before me? I could barely remember their names. How could I know anything about what I had inherited from them? Our counselor explained that my Jewish ancestry might raise the possibility of Tay-Sachs disease, a nerve-destroying disorder caused by inheriting two mutant copies of a gene called Hexa. The fact that my mother wasn't Jewish lowered the odds that I had the mutation, and even if I did, Grace's Irish ancestry probably meant we had nothing to worry about. The more we talked about our genes, the more alien they felt to me. My mutation seemed to flicker in my DNA like red warning lights. Maybe one of the lights was on a copy of my hexagene. Maybe I had others in genes that scientists had yet to name, but could still wreak havoc on our child. I had willingly become a conduit for heredity, allowing the biological past to make its way into the future, and yet I had no idea of what I was passing on. Our counselor kept trying to flush out clues. Did any relatives die of cancer? What kind? How old were they? Anyone have a stroke? I tried to build a medical pedigree for her, but all I could recall were secondhand stories. I recalled William Zimmer, my father's father, who died in his 40s from a heart attack. I think a heart attack? But didn't an old cousin once tell me about rumors of overwork and despair? His wife, my grandmother, died of some kind of cancer, I knew. Was it her ovaries or her lymph nodes? She had died years before I was born, and no one had wanted to burden me as a child with the oncological particulars. How, I wondered, could someone like me, with so little grasp of his own heredity, be permitted to have a child? It was then, in a panic, that I recalled an uncle I had never met. I didn't even know he existed until I was a teenager. One day, my mother told me about her brother, Harry, how she would visit Harry's crib every morning to say hello. One morning, the crib was empty. The story left me flummoxed, outraged. It wouldn't be until I was much older that I'd appreciate how doctors in the 1950s ordered parents to put children like Harry in a home and move on with their lives. I had no grasp of the awkward shame that would make those children all the more invisible. I tried to describe Uncle Harry to our genetics counselor, but I might as well have tried sketching a ghost. As I blathered on, I convinced myself that our child was in danger. Whatever Harry had inherited from our ancestors had traveled silently into me, and from me it had traveled to my child, in whom it would cause some sort of disaster. The counselor didn't look worried as I spoke. That irritated me. She asked me if I knew anything about Harry's condition. Was it Fragile X? What did his hands and feet look like? I had no answers. I had never met him. I had never even tried to track him down. I suppose I had been frightened of him gazing at me as he would at any stranger. We might share some DNA, but did we share anything that really mattered? Well, the counselor said calmly, Fragile X is carried on the X chromosome, so we don't have to worry about that. Her calmness now looked to me like sheer incompetence. How can you be so sure? I asked. We would know, she assured me. How would we know? I demanded. The counselor smiled with the steadiness of a diplomat meeting a dictator. You'd be severely retarded, she said. She started to draw again, just to make sure I understood what she was saying. Women have two X chromosomes, she explained, and men have one X and one Y. A woman with a fragile X mutation on one copy of her X chromosome will be healthy, because her other X chromosome can compensate. Men have no backup. If I carried the mutation, it would have been obvious from when I was a baby. I listened to the rest of her lesson without interrupting. A few months later, Grace gave birth to our child, a girl as it turned out. We named her Charlotte. When I carried her out of the hospital in a baby seat, I couldn't believe that we were being entrusted with this life. She didn't display any sign of a hereditary disease. She grew and thrived. I looked for heredity's prints on Charlotte's clay. I inspected her face, aligning photos of her with snapshots of Grace as a baby. Sometimes I thought I could hear heredity. To my ear, at least, she has her mother's laugh. As I write this, Charlotte is now 15. She has a 13-year-old sister named Veronica. Watching them grow up, I have pondered heredity even more. I wondered about the source of their different shades of skin color, the tint of their irises, Charlotte's obsession with the dark matter of the universe, or Veronica's gift for singing. She didn't get that from me. Well, she certainly didn't get it from me. Those thoughts led me to wonder about heredity itself. It is a word that we all know. Nobody needs an introduction to it, the way we might to meiosis or allele. We all feel like we're on a first-name basis with heredity. We use it to make sense of some of the most important parts of our lives. Yet it means many different things to us, which often don't line up with each other. Heredity is why we're like our ancestors. Heredity is the inheritance of a gift or of a curse. Heredity defines us through our biological past. It also gives us a chance at immortality by extending heredity into the future. I began to dig into heredity's history and ended up in an underground palace. For millennia, humans have told stories about how the past gave rise to the present, how people resemble their parents, or, for some reason, do not. And yet no one used the word heredity as we do today before the 1700s. The modern concept of heredity as a matter worthy of scientific investigation didn't gel for another century after that. Charles Darwin helped turn it into a scientific question, a question he did his best to answer. He failed spectacularly. In the early 1900s, the birth of genetics seemed to offer an answer at last. Gradually, people translated their old notions and values about heredity into a language of genes. As the technology for studying genes grew cheaper and faster, people became comfortable with examining their own DNA. They began to order genetic tests to link themselves to missing parents, to distant ancestors, to racial identities. Genes became the blessing and the curse that our ancestors bestowed on us. But very often, genes cannot give us what we really want from heredity. Each of us carries an amalgam of fragments of DNA, stitched together from some of our many ancestors. Each piece has its own ancestry, traveling a different path back through human history. A particular fragment may sometimes be cause for worry, but most of our DNA influences who we are, our appearance, our height, our penchants, in inconceivably subtle ways. While we may expect too much from our inherited genes, we also don't give heredity the full credit it's due. We've come to define heredity purely as the genes that parents pass down to their children. But heredity continues within us, as a single cell gives rise to a pedigree of trillions of cells that make up our entire bodies. And if we want to say we inherit genes from our ancestors, using a word that once referred to kingdoms and estates, then we should consider the possibility that we inherit other things that matter greatly to our existence, from the microbes that swarm our bodies to the technology we use to make life more comfortable for ourselves. We should try to redefine the word heredity, to create a more generous definition that's closer to nature than to our demands and fears. I woke up one bright September morning and hoisted Charlotte, now 2 months old, from her crib. As Grace caught up on her sleep, I carried Charlotte to the living room, trying to keep her quiet. She was irascible, and the only way I could calm her was to bounce her in my arms. To fill the morning hours, I kept the television on. The chatter of local news and celebrity trivia, the pleasant weather forecast, a passing report of a small fire in an office at the World Trade Center. Having been a father for all of 2 months had made me keenly aware of the ocean of words that surrounded my family. They flowed from our television and from the mouths of friends. They looked up from newspapers and leaped down from billboards. For now, Charlotte could not make sense of these words, but they were washing over her anyway, molding her developing brain to take on the capacity for language. She would inherit English from us, along with the genes in her cells. She would inherit a world as well, a human-shaped environment that would help determine the opportunities and limits of her life. Before that morning, I felt familiar with that world. It would boast brain surgery and probes headed for Saturn. It would also be a world of spreading asphalt and shrinking forests. But the fire grew that morning, and the television hosts mentioned reports that a plane had crashed into it. I rocked Charlotte as the television wove between ads and cooking tips and a second plane crashing into the second tower. The day mushroomed into catastrophe. Charlotte's fussing faded into sleepy comfort. She looked up at me and I down at her. I realized how consumed I had become with wondering what versions of DNA she might have inherited from me. I kept my arms folded tightly around her, wondering now what sort of world she was inheriting. Part 1. A Stroke on the Cheek. Chapter 1. The Light Trifle of His Substance. The Emperor, clad in black, hobbled into the Great Hall. An audience of powerful men had assembled in the Palace of Brussels on October 25, 1555, to listen to a speech by the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V. At the time, he ruled over much of Europe, as well as wide swaths of the New World. A few years before, Titian had painted his portrait astride a war horse, encased in armor, brandishing a lance. But now, at 55, he had become toothless and blank-stared. As he made his way to the front of the hall, he had to lean on both a cane and Prince William of Orange. Trailing Charles was his 28-year-old son, Philip. There was no question that they were related. Father and son alike had lower jaws that jutted far forward, leaving their mouths to hang open. Their shared look was so distinctive that anatomists later named it after their dynasty, the Habsburg jaw. Father and son climbed together up a few steps onto a dais, where they turned and sat before the assembly. They listened to the president of the Council of Flanders announce that Charles had summoned the audience to witness his abdication. They would now have to transfer their allegiance from Charles V to Philip II, his rightful heir. Charles then rose from the throne and put on a pair of spectacles. He read from a page of notes, reflecting on his 40-year reign. Over those decades, he had expanded his power across much of the world. In addition to Spain, he ruled the Holy Roman Empire, the Low Countries, and much of Italy. His power extended from Mexico to Peru, where his armies had recently crushed the Inca Empire. Waves of ships rolled back east across the Atlantic, arriving at Spanish ports to unload gold and silver. Starting in the 1540s, however, Charles had begun to flag. He developed gout and hemorrhoids. His battles now ended in fewer victories and more stalemates. Charles grew depressed, sometimes so despondent he would lock himself away in a chamber. His chief consolation was his son. Charles had put Philip in charge of Spain when he was still just a teenager, and Philip had amply proven himself fit to inherit Charles's power. Now, in 1555, Charles was content to make him a king. As he finished his speech, he turned to Philip. "May the Almighty bless you with a son," he said, "to whom, when old and stricken with disease, you may be able to resign your kingdom with the same good will with which I now resign mine to you." It took a couple of years for all the formalities to get squared away, for Charles to retire to a monastery that he filled with clocks, and for his son to be crowned. But during all that time, the transition rolled along smoothly. No one objected to transferring their allegiance. What could be more natural, after all, than a prince succeeding his father? For anyone else to take control of the empire would have been to defy the laws of heredity. Heredity, herencia in Spanish, heredité in French, heredita in Italian, originally came from the Latin word hereditas. The Romans did not use their word as we typically use ours today, to describe the process by which we inherit genes and other parts of our biology. They used hereditas as a legal term, referring to the state of being an heir. If we become heirs to a certain person, the jurist Gaius wrote, that person's assets pass to us. It sounded simple enough, but Romans fought bitterly over heredity. Their conflicts accounted for 2/3 of all the lawsuits in Roman courts. If a wealthy man died without a will, his children would be first in line to inherit his fortune, except any daughters who had married into other families. Next in line would be the father's brothers and their children, then more distantly related kin. Rome's system was one among many. Among the Iroquois, a child might have many mothers. In many South American societies, a child could have many fathers. Any man who had sex with a pregnant woman was considered a parent to her unborn child. In some societies, kinship had meaning only through the father's line, others only through the mother's. The Apinaia of Brazil had it both ways. The men traced their ancestry back through their father's line, while the Apinaia women traced theirs back through their mother's. The words people used for their kin reflected how they organized relatives into a constellation of heredity. Hawaiians, for example, could use the same term for both sisters and female cousins. Medieval Europe inherited some of Rome's hereditary customs, but over the centuries, new rules emerged. In some countries, the sons split their father's land. In others, only the eldest inherited it. In others still, it went to the youngest son. In the early Middle Ages, daughters sometimes became heirs too, but as the centuries passed, they were mostly shut out. As Europe grew wealthier, new hereditary rules took hold to keep the fortunes intact. The most powerful families of all took on titles and crowns, which were handed down through hereditary succession to a son, preferably. If not, then a daughter or perhaps a grandnephew. Sometimes the branches of a dead monarch's family would fight for the crown, justifying their claim on heredity. But these claims became hard to judge when the memories of ancestors faded. Noble families fought this forgetting by putting their genealogies in writing. In the Middle Ages, Venice's great council created the Golden Book, which every son from the prominent old families of the Republic signed on his 18th birthday. Only those whose names were recorded in the book could become members of the council. As unbroken lines of descent from noble ancestors became more important, leading families paid artists for visual propaganda. At first they represented heredity as vertical lines, but later they started painting simple trees. They might paint the founder of a noble lineage at the base of the tree, and his descendants perched on branches. The French gave these pictures a name in honor of their forking shape, pedigree, meaning crane's foot. In English, the word became pedigree. By the 1400s, pedigrees had become instantly recognizable, as evidenced by a pageant that was put on in 1432 to honor Henry VI of England. The king, only 10 years old at the time, had been crowned King of France. On his return to London, the city came out in force to celebrate his expanded power. Giant tableaux lined his path. He passed towers and tabernacles. Londoners dressed up as grace, fortune, and wisdom, as well as a multitude of angels. The centerpiece of the city-wide display was a castle constructed from green jasper, displaying a pair of trees. One tree traced Henry's ancestry back to the early kings of both England and France. The other was a tree that traced Jesus' ancestry all the way back to King David and beyond. These trees were a blend of fact and fiction, of display and concealment. They represented only those supposed ancestors whose kinship bolstered Henry's claim to power. The trees lacked siblings and cousins, bastards and wives. The most important omission of all was the House of York, Henry's rivals to the throne. But erasing them from Henry's tree did not erase them from history. Henry VI would be murdered at 49, after which the House of York seized control of England. When Charles V abdicated in 1555, he created a pageant of his own. Father and son stood on stage, side by side. The nobleman who sat before the emperor and his prince silently endorsed the hereditary transfer of power. Perhaps, as they listened to Charles deliver his speech, they turned their gaze from father to son and back. If they settled their gaze on the royal jaws, they would not have said that Charles had inherited his jaw from his father. They could recognize a family resemblance, but they did not explain it with the language of thrones and estates. To account for why Charles and Philip looked alike, 16th-century Europeans relied largely on the teachings of ancient Greeks and Romans. The Greek physician Hippocrates argued that men and women both produced semen, and that new life formed when the two were mixed. That blending accounted for how children ended up with a mix of their parents' characteristics. Aristotle disagreed, believing that only men produced the seeds of life. Their seeds grew on menstrual blood inside women's bodies, developing into embryos. Aristotle and his followers believed a woman could influence the traits of her children, but only in the way the soil can influence how an acorn grows into an oak tree. The mother is not the true parent of the child which is called hers, the Greek playwright Aeschylus wrote. She is a nurse who tends the growth of young seed planted by the true parent, the male. The classical world had less to say about why different parents passed down different traits. Why some people were tall and others short, why some were dark and others pale. One widespread notion was that new differences arose through experiences. In other words, people could pass down a trait they acquired during their lives. In ancient Rome, for example, there was a prominent family called the Ahenobarbi. Their name means red beard, a trait that set them apart in bright contrast to Rome's dark-haired majority. The Ahenobarbi themselves had started out dark-haired as well, according to legend. But one day, a member of the Ahenobarbi clan, a man named Lucius Domitius, was traveling home to Rome when he encountered the demigods Castor and Pollux, otherwise known as the Gemini twins. They told Domitius to deliver news to Rome that they had won a great battle, and then Castor and Pollux stroked his cheek. With that divine touch, the beard of Domitius turned the color of bronze, and he then passed down his red beard to all his male descendants. Hippocrates provided his medical authority to another story of acquired traits, about a tribe known as the Longheads. A long head was a sign of nobility for the tribe, prompting parents to squeeze the skulls of newborns and wrap them in bandages. Custom originally so acted that through force such a nature came into being, Hippocrates said. Eventually, long-head babies came into the world with their heads already stretched out. Other Greeks told similar stories, of men who lost fingers, for example, and then fathered fingerless children. For the seed, Hippocrates wrote, comes from all parts of the body, healthy seed from healthy parts, diseased seed from diseased parts. If those parts changed during a person's life, his or her seeds changed accordingly. The place where people lived could also shape them, the Greeks believed, and even give them some of their national character. The people of cold countries generally, and particularly those of Europe, are full of spirit, but deficient in skill and intelligence, Aristotle declared. They were therefore unfit to govern themselves or others. Asians had skill and intelligence, but lacked spirit, which was why they lived under the rule of despots. The Greeks, intermediate in geographical position, unite the qualities of both sets of peoples, Aristotle wrote. The theories of Aristotle and other ancient writers were preserved by Arab scholars, from whom Europeans learned of them in the Middle Ages. In the 1200s, the philosopher Albertus Magnus declared that the temperature and humidity of people's birthplace determined the color of their skin. Indians were especially good at math, Albertus thought, because the influence of the stars was especially strong in India. But over the next three centuries, Europeans developed a new explanation for the link between one generation and the next. They were joined by blood. Even today, Westerners still use the word blood to talk about kinship, as if the two were equivalent in some obvious way. But other cultures thought of kinship in terms of other substances. On the Malaysian island of Langkawi, to pick just one counterexample, people traditionally believed that children gained kinship through what they ate. They consumed the same milk as their siblings, and they later ate the same rice grown from the same soil. These beliefs are so strong among the Langkawi that if children from two families nurse from the same woman, a marriage between them would be considered incest. The European concept of blood gave ancestry a different form. It sealed off kinship from the outside world. A child was born with the blood of its parents coursing through its veins and inherited all that went with it. Philip II was fit to inherit his father's crown because he had royal blood, which came from his father, and his grandfather before that. Genealogies became bloodlines, serving as proof that noble families were not tainted with lower-class blood. The Habsburgs were especially protective of their royal blood, only marrying other members of their extended family. Charles V married Isabella of Portugal, for example. They were both grandchildren of King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella of Spain. Before long, Europeans even began to sort animals according to their blood. Of all birds, falcons had the noblest blood, and falconry was thus suitable to be the sport of kings. If a falcon mated with a less noble bird, the chicks were called bastards. Noblemen also became connoisseurs of dogs and horses, paying fortunes for pure-blooded breeds. For animals no less than people, inheriting noble blood meant inheriting noble traits like bravery and strength. No experience could hide the virtue carried in the blood of man or beast. In a medieval romance called Octavian, the Roman emperor of the same name unknowingly fathers a child named Florentine, who ends up being raised by a butcher. Even in that lowly household, Florentine's noble blood cannot be masked. His adoptive father sends him to the market to sell two oxen, and Florentine trades them instead for a sparrowhawk. In the 1400s, people began to use a new word to define a group of animals that shared the same blood, a race. A Spanish manual from around 1430 offered breeders tips for providing a good race of horse. Their stallion must be good and beautiful and of good coat, and the mare that she be large and well-formed and of good coat. Before long, people were assigned to races as well. A priest named Alfonso Martinez de Toledo declared in 1438 that it's easy to tell the difference between men belonging to good and bad races. It doesn't matter how they're raised, Martinez de Toledo said. Imagine that the son of a laborer and the son of a knight are reared together on some isolated mountain away from their parents. The laborer's son would end up enjoying working in a farm field, Martinez de Toledo promised, while the knight's son would take pleasure only in riding horses and sword fighting. The good man of good race always returns to his origins, he wrote, whereas the miserable man of bad race or lineage, no matter how powerful or how rich, will always return to the villainy from which he descends. In the late 1400s, Jews in Spain found themselves defined as a race of their own. For centuries, Jews across Europe had been tormented for all sorts of concocted crimes against Christians. In 15th century Spain, thousands of Jews tried to escape this persecution by converting to Christianity, becoming so-called conversos. The self-proclaimed old Christians remained hostile, rejecting the idea that Jews could escape their sinful inheritance with a mere oath. Nor could their children, for that matter, because Jewish immorality was carried in their blood and embedded in their seed, passed down from one generation to the next. From the days of Alexander up till now, there has never been a treasonous act that did not involve a Jew or his descendants, the Spanish historian Gutierrez Diaz de Gomez declared in 1435. Spanish writers began referring to unconverted Jews and conversos alike as the Jewish race. Christian men were warned not to have children with a woman of the Jewish race in the same way that a fine stallion shouldn't be bred with a mare from a lower caste. In 1449, the Spanish city of Toledo began turning this hostility into law, decreeing that even a trace of Jewish blood disqualified a subject from holding office or marrying a true Christian. The ban spread across Spain, expanding its scope along the way. Jewish blood now barred people from getting university degrees, inheriting estates, or even entering some parts of the country. In order to define Jews as a separate race, the majority of Spain had to define itself as a race of its own. Noble families now claimed that their genealogies extended back to the Visigoths. They boasted of the cleanliness of their blood, known as limpieza de sangre. They extolled the pale skin of old Christians, which revealed the sangre azul, blue blood, coursing in the vessels beneath. The phrase would survive for centuries and cross the Atlantic, becoming a label for upper-class New Englanders. Official certificates of purity were required for marriages between powerful Spanish families and for lucrative government posts. The Spanish Inquisition would follow up with their own detective work, getting testimony from relatives and neighbors. The inquisitors would investigate any rumor of Jewish ancestry. A report that an ancestor worked as a clothes merchant or a moneylender could be enough to arouse suspicion. The discovery of even a single Jew in one's ancestry could spell doom. Wealthy families would hire special race researchers, called linajudos, to marshal proof of their limpieza de sangre. Of course, just about every noble family actually did have some Jewish ancestry. The linajudos grew rich by inventing chronicles that left it out. The label of race emerged around the time that Europeans began colonizing other parts of the world. They discovered more people to whom they could attach the label. I have found no monsters, Christopher Columbus wrote in a letter from the Caribbean in 1493. Instead of cyclopses or Amazons, he encountered people, whom he named Indians. Columbus was not sure what to make of them at first. They seemed to flout Aristotle's rule about skin color. Even though they lived under a fierce sun, their skin was not black like that of Africans. They lacked clothes, steel, or weapons. Yet Columbus was impressed by their skill in building and piloting canoes. A galley could not compete with them by rowing, because they travel incredibly fast, he said. They are of subtle intelligence and can find their way around those seas. While Columbus may have found some things to admire in the Native Americans he encountered, he didn't hesitate to force them into slavery. He dispatched some to work on farms or in mines. He sent hundreds more to Spain to be sold, although most died during the voyage across the Atlantic. Conquistadors and settlers followed Columbus's example. While some theologians pleaded that they treat Native Americans more humanely, others justified slavery by race. They declared Native Americans to be natural slaves, incapable of reason and designed by God to serve European masters. For them there is no tomorrow, and they are content that they have enough to eat and drink for a week, wrote the Spanish jurist Juan Matienzo. Nature proportioned their bodies so that they should have strength for personal service, said another scholar. The Spaniards, on the other hand, are delicately proportioned and were made prudent and clever so that they should be able to lead a political and civil life. Yet Native Americans suffered so badly from new diseases and hard labor that their population collapsed. In response, Charles V outlawed their slavery, although many ended up as impoverished peasants toiling on haciendas. Now a new supply of workers had to be imported to take their place, African slaves. For centuries, a vigorous slave trade had moved people out of sub-Saharan Africa into Europe, the Near East, and South Asia. The enslavers justified the practice by dehumanizing the enslaved. In 1377, the Tunisian scholar Ibn Khaldun declared that Africans, as well as Slavs, another enslaved population, possess attributes that are quite similar to those of dumb animals. But Khaldun still subscribed to a Hippocratic view of heredity. The black Africans who moved north into the cold climate of Europe, Khaldun claimed, were found to produce descendants whose color gradually turned white. Muslims first brought African slaves into Spain in the 8th century, and their numbers grew as Portuguese traders captured Africans and brought them back to Europe. And yet the social boundaries between slavery and freedom remained loose. Some slaves of African ancestry gained their freedom and spent the rest of their lives alongside Europeans. Some joined the crews that sailed with Columbus to the New World. As slave traders began shipping their cargo straight to Brazil, Peru, and Mexico, Europeans developed more enduring justifications of slavery. Some declared it a curse that Africans inherited from their biblical ancestors. Theologians had long claimed that Africans were the descendants of Ham, one of Noah's sons. After Ham saw his father naked, Noah cursed him, declaring that Ham's own son, Canaan, would never know freedom. A slave of slaves shall he be to his brothers, Noah said. In the 1400s, European scholars revived the story of Ham, casting it as the foundation of a distinct race, its cursed essence marked by dark skin. In 1448, the Portuguese scholar Gomes Eanes de Azurara wrote that because of Ham's sin, his race should be subject to all the other races of the world, and from this race, these blacks are descended. Of all the powerful families in Europe, none worked as hard to keep themselves free of hereditary taint as the Habsburgs. Their blood ran blue, as their detailed genealogies could attest. To maintain their purity and to keep the world's greatest empire intact, the Habsburgs only married among themselves. Cousins married cousins, uncles married nieces. And yet the more time passed, the more the Habsburgs of Spain became burdened with hereditary suffering. The Habsburg jaw was the most prominent of their afflictions. Scientists have examined the paintings of Philip II and the other Habsburg kings to make a diagnosis, and they now suspect that the Habsburgs did not actually have an enlarged lower jaw so much as a small upper jaw that failed to develop to its full size. Philip II also suffered from other troubles familiar to the Habsburg family, including asthma, epilepsy, and melancholy. To protect the family's power, Philip II married Maria Manuela, his first cousin. Genetically speaking, though, she was even more closely related than that. Philip's parents, Charles and Isabella, were also first cousins, while Maria Manuela's own parents were Charles and Isabella's siblings. Her father was Isabella's brother, and her mother was Charles's sister. The result of this close union was a sickly son born in 1545, Don Carlos. The right side of his body was less developed than the left, causing him to walk with a limp. He was born with a hunchback and a kind of deformed ribcage called pigeon chest. Don Carlos was 10 when his father became king. The boy wailed inconsolably and often refused to eat, but his many troubles didn't stop Philip from naming Don Carlos his universal heir at age 12, destined to inherit all the kingdoms Philip had inherited from his own father, Charles. By the time Don Carlos was 19, however, it was obvious to everyone, his father included, that something was very wrong. One visitor to the Spanish court wrote, "He is still like a child of 7 years." Philip himself agreed. "Although other children develop late," the king wrote, "God wishes that mine lags far behind all others." In his early 20s, Don Carlos grew violent. He once hurled a servant out of a window for displeasing him. He wasted hundreds of thousands of ducats. He tried to kill a nobleman. Philip decided that his son's natural and unique temperament would never change, and that he could not be allowed to rule. The king put on a suit of chainmail, assembled a group of armed courtiers, and stormed his son's room. They nailed Don Carlos's windows shut, removed all the weapons, papers, and treasure from the prince's room, and turned it into a prison cell. Don Carlos died there a few weeks later, on July 24, 1568, at age 23. Philip II remarried, this time choosing his own niece, Anna of Austria. In 1578, they had a son, Philip III, who succeeded his father 20 years later. Philip III married a cousin of his own and ruled until 1621, whereupon his own son, Philip IV, took over. It was during Philip IV's reign that the Spanish Empire, long the greatest power on earth, went into decline. The Spanish army grew weak, and Portugal slipped from Philip IV's grasp. Gold and silver continued to arrive from the New World, but it headed straight to bankers elsewhere in Europe rather than enriching the people of Spain, who suffered from plagues and famines. Philip IV was insulated from the chaos within the confines of his huge palace. He hung masterpieces by Rubens on the walls and listened to poets sing his praises. They called him the Planet King. The endless pageantry was disturbed only by the king's worry that his planetary throne might slip out of Habsburg hands if he didn't produce a son and heir. Along with the Habsburg jaw and other ailments, the dynasty began to suffer an increasing number of miscarriages and infant deaths. Although they were among the most pampered people on earth at the time, they suffered a higher rate of infant mortality than Spanish peasant families. Philip IV's first wife, Elizabeth of France, had a long string of miscarriages and babies who died young before her death in 1644. Their son, Balthazar Charles, managed to survive to age 17 before dying of smallpox in 1646. The Habsburg dynasty now faced a crisis. It had no heir to succeed Philip IV after his death. After Balthazar's death, Philip IV married his son's fiancée and his own niece, Mariana. In 1651, she bore the king a daughter, Margaret Teresa, who would survive for 22 years. But over the following years, she had two more children who died young. In 1661, when their son, Philip Prospero, died at age 4, Philip IV blamed their deaths on his lust for actresses. When we look back to the 17th century, it can be hard to understand why Philip IV didn't recognize that the heredity of his family was to blame. But hardly anyone at the time thought about heredity this way during the years of the Habsburg dynasty. One of the few exceptions was the writer Michel de Montaigne, who published an essay in 1580 called Of the Resemblance of Children to Their Fathers. Montaigne was a French courtier who retired from political life in 1571 to sit in a castle tower and reflect on vanity and happiness, on liars and friendship. While he found comfort in this solitude, pain intruded on his contemplation from time to time, thanks to his kidney stones. One day, Montaigne transformed the stones into grist for an essay. "It is likely I inherited the gravel from my father," Montaigne guessed, "for he died sadly afflicted by a large stone in the bladder." Yet Montaigne had no idea how one could inherit a disease, as opposed to a crown or a farm. His father had been in perfect health when Montaigne was born, and remained so for another 25 years. Only in his late 60s did his kidney stones first appear, and they then tormented him for the last 7 years of his life. While he was still so remote from the disease, How could the light trifle of his substance out of which he built me convey so deep an impress? Montaigne wondered. Where could the propensity have been brooding all this while? Simply musing in this way was a visionary act. No one in Montaigne's day thought of traits as being distinct things that could travel down through generations. People did not reproduce. They were engendered. Life unfolded as reliably as the rising of bread or the fermenting of wine. Montaigne's doctors did not picture a propensity lurking in parents and then being reproduced in their children. A trait could not disappear and be rediscovered, like a hidden letter. Doctors did sometimes observe certain diseases that were common in certain families, but they didn't think very much about why that was so. Many simply turned to the Bible for guidance, citing the passage telling of God visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation. Whatever Montaigne's doctors might have said about his father's kidney stones, he probably would have dismissed it. He hated doctors, like his father and grandfather before him. "My antipathy against their art is hereditary," he said. Montaigne wondered if such an inclination could be inherited, along with diseases and physical traits. But how all of that could be carried from one generation to another in a seed, Montaigne could not begin to imagine. "The doctor who can satisfy me on this point, I'll believe as many miracles of as he pleases," he promised, "provided he does not give me, as doctors usually do, a theory more intricate and fantastic than the thing itself." Montaigne lived for another dozen years, apparently never meeting a doctor who could satisfy him about heredity. In the year of his death, an elderly Spanish doctor named Luis Mercado was appointed by Philip II to be physician of the king's chamber. Mercado might have met Montaigne's high standards, because he was one of the few doctors in Europe to recognize that people inherit diseases, and to ask why. For decades before his appointment to the court, Mercado had taught medicine at the University of Valladolid. A colleague there called him modest in dress, sparing in diet, humble in character, simple in matter. At the university, Mercado had given lectures steeped in Aristotle's ideas. But his dedication to the ancients didn't prevent him from making observations of his own and publishing books with new ideas about fevers and plagues. And in 1605, at age 80, Mercado published his masterwork, De Morbis Hereditariis, on hereditary diseases. It was the first book dedicated to the subject. Mercado sought an explanation for why diseases ran in families. He dismissed the possibility that they were divine punishments. Instead, to understand hereditary diseases, Mercado believed it was necessary to understand how new lives develop. He argued that each part of the body, a hand, the heart, an eye, had its own distinctive shape, its own balance of humors, and its own particular function. In the bloodstream, Mercado claimed, the humors from each part of the body mixed together, and a mysterious formative power shaped them into seeds. Unlike Aristotle, Mercado believed that both men and women produced seeds, which were combined through sex. The same formative power acted on those joined seeds, producing from them a new supply of humors that gave rise to a new human being that developed the same parts as its parents. Mercado believed that this cycle of generation, combination, and development was well shielded from the outside world. The willy-nilly waves of chance could not reach the hidden seeds of human life and alter their hereditary traits. He dismissed popular notions about the power of the environment, that a mother's imagination could alter her baby, or that dogs taught new tricks could pass them down to their puppies. A hereditary disease was like a stamp that marked a seed. The same stamp appeared on each new generation's seeds and gave rise to the same disease. The bringing forth of individuals similar to oneself and deformed by the same defect, Mercado wrote. In his experience with patients, royal and common, Mercado had seen many different kinds of hereditary diseases. Some could strike immediately. A child could be born deaf, for example, while others were slower to emerge, like the kidney stones that afflicted Montaigne as they had his father. In many cases, Mercado came to believe, parents impressed only a tendency toward a disease on their children. A child's humors might be able to weaken that impression. Or a healthy parent's seed could sometimes counter a diseased one. The defect still lurked in the child, who could then pass it down to its own children. If they didn't inherit a countervailing seed from their other parents, the disease could flare up out of hiding. Some hereditary diseases could be treated, Mercado argued, but only slowly and incompletely. Let us in some secluded spot teach the deaf and dumb to speak by forming and articulating the voice, he wrote. By long practice, many with hereditary affliction have regained their speech and hearing. But, for the most part, the doctor could do little, because the stamp of heredity was sealed away from a physician's reach. Mercado urged instead that people with the same defect not marry, because their children would be at greatest risk of developing the same hereditary disease. All people should seek out a spouse as different from themselves in as many individual characteristics as possible. Mercado went remarkably far toward answering Montaña's questions about heredity, but the world was not ready to investigate his ideas. The scientific revolution was decades away, and it would take 2 centuries more before heredity itself would come to be seen as a scientific question. No one, not even Mercado himself, it seems, could recognize that his own royal patients were in the midst of staging their own hereditary disaster. By preserving their noble blood, they were increasing the number of disease-causing mutations in their lines. They were lowering their odds of having children, and the children who beat those odds were then at grave risk of inheriting mutations that would give them a host of diseases. By 1660, Philip IV had been trying to produce a male heir for 40 years. In that time, he fathered 12 children. 10 died young, and the surviving 2 were girls. As Philip grew older, the survival of the entire Habsburg dynasty fell into jeopardy. The following year, at last, the empire celebrated the birth of a son who would become king. Charles, the new prince, was most beautiful in features, large head, dark skin, and somewhat overplump, according to the official gazette. Spain's royal astrologers declared the stars at Charles's birth to be well arranged, all of which promised a happy and fortunate life and reign. When Charles was only 3, his father died. On his deathbed, gazing at the crucifix on the wall before him, Philip IV could console himself that he had forged a new link in heredity's chain, leaving behind a boy king. King Charles II of Spain proved to be the sickest Habsburg monarch of them all. He seems extremely weak, an ambassador wrote back to France, with pale cheeks and very open mouth. The ambassador observed a nurse usually carried him from place to place so that he would not have to walk. The doctors do not foretell a long life, the ambassador reported. Charles II, born 6 decades after Mercado published On Hereditary Diseases, managed to survive to manhood, although his health remained poor and his mind weak. Famines and wars unfolded around him, but he preferred to distract himself with bullfights. The only national matter with which he concerned himself was producing an heir of his own, and even in that task, he failed. As the years passed without his queen becoming pregnant, Charles grew more ill. He has a ravenous stomach and swallows all he eats whole, for his nether jaw stands so much out that his 2 rows of teeth cannot meet, a British ambassador reported, to compensate which, he has a prodigious wide throat, so that a gizzard or liver of a hen passes down whole, and his weak stomach not being able to digest it, he voids in the same manner. The Spanish Inquisition blamed the lack of an heir on witches, but their trials did nothing to help the king. It became clear he would die soon, yet Charles managed to dither for months over whom to name as his heir. Finally, in October 1700, he selected the Duke of Anjou, the grandson of the King of France. Charles worried that the empire might collapse after his death, and so he issued a demand that his heir rule without allowing the least dismemberment nor diminishing of the monarchy founded with such glory by my ancestors. But his monarchy soon began disintegrating anyway. The prospect of France and Spain forming an alliance prompted England to form an alliance of its own with many of the other great powers in Europe. Skirmishes began breaking out, both in Europe and in the New World. Eventually, the fighting would escalate into the War of Spanish Succession. The conflict would change the planet's political landscape, leaving England ascendant and Spain broken. Yet Charles still dreamed that his empire would remain whole. He even added a codicil to his will, stating his wishes that the Duke of Anjou would marry one of his Habsburg cousins in Austria. Not long afterward, he grew so ill that he could no longer hear or speak. Charles died on November 1, 1700. He was only 35. There was no child left to inherit his empire, because of invisible things Charles had inherited from his ancestors. When doctors examined the king's cadaver, they found that his liver contained 3 stones. His kidneys were awash in water. His heart, they reported, was the size of a small nut. Chapter 2. Traveling Across the Face of Time. In 1904, a 55-year-old Dutchman, heavily built and sporting a graying beard, boarded a ship bound for New York. Hugo de Vries was a university professor in Amsterdam, but he was not a hothouse inhabitant of lecture halls. He spent much of his time wandering the Dutch countryside, scanning meadows for exceptional wildflowers. An English colleague once complained that his clothes were foul and that he changed his shirt once a week. When de Vries' ship docked in New York, he boarded a train that pushed its way across the country to California. The official reason for the journey was to visit scientists at Stanford University and the University of California at Berkeley. De Vries dutifully gave his lectures and went to the required evening banquets, but as soon as he could manage, he escaped north. 50 miles from San Francisco, de Vries arrived in a small farming town called Santa Rosa. With 4 fellow scientists in tow, he made his way from the train station to a 4-acre plot ringed by low picket fences and crammed with gardens. A modest vine-covered house sat in the middle of the property, flanked by a glass-roofed greenhouse and a barn. A boxwood-lined path led from the street to the front porch of the house. Next to the path stood a blue and white sign informing visitors that all interviews were limited to 5 minutes, unless they were by appointment. Fortunately, de Vries had one. A small, stooped man about his own age, outfitted in a rough brown suit, came out to greet the visiting party. His name was Luther Burbank. Burbank shared the house in the middle of the garden with his sister and mother. He had been expecting de Vries' arrival for months and set aside an evening and a day for the visit. He showed off his garden to the scientists and then took them to an 18-acre farm he tended in the Sonoma foothills. Those 2 plots of land and the plants that sprouted from their soil had made Burbank both rich and famous. "His results are so stupendous," de Vries later wrote, "that they receive the admiration of the whole world." This was no exaggeration. Each year, Burbank's postman brought him 30,000 letters. Henry Ford and Thomas Edison traveled to Santa Rosa to meet him. Newspapers regularly praised Burbank, calling him the Wizard of Horticulture. The Burbank potato, which he produced at age 24, was already the standard breed for farmers across much of the United States. The Shasta daisy sprang into existence under Burbank's care and quickly became a mainstay in middle-class flower beds. In his gardens, Burbank created thousands of different kinds of plants, the white blackberry, the paradox walnut, the spineless cactus. Such a knowledge of nature and such ability to handle plant life would only be possible to an innately high genius, de Vries had declared to a group of Stanford scientists on the eve of his trip to Santa Rosa. Before his meeting with Burbank, de Vries wondered how much of what was written about him was true. The San Francisco Call said that Burbank's flowers thrive upon a scale so extensive as to suggest magic rather than the sober work of science. Sometimes Burbank's catalogs read like fairy tales. In one edition, de Vries saw that Burbank was now offering a stoneless plum. He simply couldn't believe such a thing could be created. When de Vries finally reached Santa Rosa, he asked for proof. Burbank led de Vries and his other visitors to a plum tree bowed down with blue fruit. He gave each man a plum, and when they bit down, their teeth met only soft sweetness. "Although we knew there was no stone in the plum, we experienced a feeling of wonder and astonishment," de Vries wrote. De Vries was not one for much wonder. He was a scientist to his marrow, and before his trip to California, he had spent the previous 2 decades running experiments that helped establish the first genuine science of heredity. Not long before his visit to Burbank, it had been given a proper name, genetics. But genetics in 1904 was like a barely started house, more footings than walls. It still left fundamental questions about heredity unanswered. De Vries knew that he and his fellow geneticists were really just newcomers to heredity's mysteries, that other people had been plumbing them for thousands of years. He respected the wisdom of animal and plant breeders, although he also recognized much of their ancient wisdom had disappeared into unrecorded oblivion. Over the course of the 1700s and 1800s, some breeders became rich. Nations looked to them to work miracles on heredity to deliver economic salvation. And at the debut of the 20th century, there was no greater breeder than Luther Burbank. He had dedicated decades to understanding what he called the inherent constitutional life force, with all its acquired habits, the sum of which is heredity. DeVries came to Santa Rosa to learn what Burbank had learned about heredity in order to push genetics out of its infancy.